Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Boy, oh boy, it was a busy week with a lot of companies pushing news out to the market as we entered early on conference season, especially in Vancouver. Three conferences that are ongoing and tying into Sunday, Monday at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. We see this every year where companies at the beginning of the year, especially in an environment where metals are going higher, well, all of a sudden everybody has news and thankfully they all want to come on the show and talk about it. So be sure to go back and listen to a lot of those company interviews. We are focusing this weekend show on the resource space, more driving down into the companies because of the fact that I think a lot of you hopefully are at some of those conferences. And again, just so much news has come out. We are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, when we talked with you throughout last year, which was broadly a down year for the metals outside of Q4, you had mentioned that, well, you just hadn't been making too many transactions, too many moves within the fund that you run. Now that we entered a new year and now that precious metals especially are in an uptrend, even copper, other metals are in uptrends for a couple months here, what is your portfolio strategy for this year?
Thanks for having me back on the program, Corey and Shad. Happy New Year's to you both. It's much of the same to what we discussed last year. You're correct. It was quite a quiet year from a you know, investment deployment perspective. I think we added four names over the course of the year, and the most recent name that we added would have been back in September 2022. Last year was much more about conserving a cash position and, you know, gradually deploying the cash that we had mostly into existing holdings. So I just sent out the most recent MJG partnership letter. It's available on our website at mjgcapital.com if anybody wants to give it a look. And in essence, we're sitting at just below a 10% cash position, which, you know, relative to where we've sat since the fund's inception is elevated. It's not extreme, but I would say it's elevated. The plan here is to continue to deploy the cash and bits and pieces here over the next, you know, 12, 15 months to the point that we're fully deployed by early 2024. However, if we see a very sharp move in the broader market, and I'm mentioning the broader markets, not the TSXV or related mining indexes, you know, I'm still a believer, and perhaps I'm being overly pessimistic here, but I think there is more pain to come in the broader indices. Just the excesses that we saw built up and kind of come to a head in 2021, both between monetary and fiscal support, and then also just the investment psychology of the general investment populace. That was a pretty extreme combination, and I think there's more unwinding to do. I may be wrong on that. It's quite possible that the broader markets already made their lows, you know, in the past 90 days, we'll say mid-November, and are now rallying on to new all-time highs. But I struggle to hold that belief. So I'm going to be a little bit more conservative here. If we see, you know, broader markets continue to move, especially around the expectations and then the possible delivery of a pause in the Fed rate hike cycle, at that point, I would very much consider getting our cash position closer to the 15 or 20% range and then going back to gradual deployment. So I'm not ready to throw all caution to the wind and go all in here. There's no question it's been an awesome start to the year over for the past 3-4 weeks in the junior space. We have, you know, over a half a dozen names that are up double digit percentage point wise. The TSXV is up close to double digits percentage wise. So it's been a strong start. I am more confident saying that precious metals, you know, gold and silver specifically, I'm feeling more and more confident that we did come to reach a definitive bottom in early Q4 of 2022 after a two plus year grinding drawdown that began in August, September timeframe in 2020. with many of hands shaken out. Only the strongest hands really remain in the PM stocks. There's, you know, strong macro narratives with continued central bank buying of gold globally. And then I also think the fight over the U.S. debt limit is going to kind of crescendo here over the next 4 or 5 months. So feeling good about the precious metals in particular. We're about 50% weighted towards gold, silver, or PGMs, which is the highest weighting we've had towards precious metals since late 2020. So that's a change. I'm feeling good there. The rest of the metals complex, though, I'm cautious about. It's going to be a very interesting push and pull between a broader global slowdown and the reopening of the Chinese economy. And right now, the reopening of China has definitely won out. We've seen massive moves in the prices of copper and iron ore and other GDP-linked metals. But I do think the jury is still out. Firstly, how quickly and how aggressively China will reopen. And then secondly, how much this will be outweighed by a slowdown in the rest of the global economies that have already been open for some time here. So I remain cautious on the battery metals and the critical minerals, even though I think the narrative for the next, you know, 3, 5, 7 years looks very promising for both.
Well, Matt, that's a great summation of kind of the macro factors that we're faced with in these markets. They've been constructive for the general markets, really for almost all markets. You've seen the cryptoverse spike higher over the last couple of months. You've seen risk on assets back on. But the commodities in general have done well. And in particular, the metals have shined. Q4 at the early, when silver bottomed first, and then GDX and GDXJ, and then eventually gold, and they started trucking higher. They've continued that momentum into the beginning of this year. But you mentioned, you know, the worries about China reopening. Will it happen? Will it not happen? The potential of recession, that maybe it's not an all clear yet. When you brought up the base metals and battery metals and critical minerals, you said you're a little more cautious. I'd love you to unpack how you think that'll play out for, let's say, the battery metals and critical mineral space, because I know you follow it so closely.
Sure. Well, and we've discussed this before on this program, but the concern I have there with, especially with the lithium juniors, I mean, we've just seen an explosion of lithium-focused names. And that, to me, is not a sign that things have to go down imminently, but it's a sign that a certain cycle is coming to a close. I mean, we have probably close to 150 to 200 lithium companies at this point spread between North America and Australia. And it seems like every day, formerly focused gold junior has, you know, found a potential pegmatite discovery on a corner of one of their previously gold focused projects. So I'm quite skeptical there. You know, uranium, for instance, fantastic metal, very interesting macro outlook there for the next 3-5 years. I think it's a great place to be invested. That said, you know, partially because of its positive outlook, there's still a bunch of speculative excitement built into the junior uranium names, for instance, or the junior lithium names. And so my concern, you know, going back to precious metals, we had a 2-year drawdown before this likely October bottom just a few months ago. All but the weakest hands were shaken out of precious metal stocks. Sentiment levels reached not all-time lows or absolute lows, but it was pretty ugly out there. Whereas if you look at much of the rest of the metal complex, you know, as recently as March of 2022, you know, in the aftermath of the Russia invasion of Ukraine, you know, we had the whole metal complex absent gold and silver, you know, rocking and rolling in that period. And so, yes, you know, folks have certainly been shaken out over the past 6 or 9 months, but it hasn't been the degree of drawdown that we saw in PMs. And that tells me that there's still quite a bit of speculative money, you know, focused in the critical mineral space, focused on these energy or battery metals, however you want to define them. And they'll do great. Like if we've seen the bottom of in the broader markets in Q4 of 2022, and we're off to the races now, like these companies will, you know, should do great from a share price performance perspective. My concern, though, is that the broader markets have a ways to go, and there's, you know, some more intense risk off periods to come. And in those periods, I think stocks that have, you know, a decent speculative premium already built into them are more vulnerable. I mean, if we go into a true risk off scenario and, you know, in 60 days from now, the market is at, you know, lows not seen even in 2022, then I think all, you know, metal equities will be hit. You know, in the very short term, our space is highly, highly correlated to major market moves. But my sense is that in the PM names, the downside will be more limited than some of these, you know, quote unquote, sexier metals. Because it is true, like the critical metals narrative and story here over the coming decade is really exciting. Like we've seen an unprecedented amount of support just over the past 12 months, really from Western governments globally. But in the most recent investor letter, I honed in on the U.S. government and Canadian government and moves that they've made over the past 12 months. And it's a pretty intense list. And it's even more surprising that this is happening with two left-leaning administrations kind of at the helms of each respective company. So I think it's real. It shows where the mining industry is likely going over the medium to long term. But just because there's government support, you know, has no bearing, in my opinion, in the short term in terms of these metal price fluctuations. And, you know, as we all know on this call, you can be very right about a metals given direction over a 3 or 5 year time horizon and very wrong in 6 months. So it wouldn't be surprising for me to see lithium prices down 70%, you know, in the next 12 months, even if it's lithium focused investments turn out to be a good bet over the next 5 years. So I think folks need to pace themselves.
Yeah, fair enough. Still early on for these sectors, right? But that can also add some of that early on fervor that brings in more investors. The interesting thing just has been, I think, more generalists, people that aren't usually invested in the resource sector, looking at some of these new metals. When you're looking at the critical metals, because of the fact that governments are so supportive, and as you said, there are just way too many juniors already that flew in here. If you were to play the critical minerals, would you focus more on the larger companies, ones that could maybe take advantage of that potential free government money easier and quicker?
Yeah, I think you really need to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And it's also going to depend on an investor's risk profile. I mean, in terms of MJG, our median market cap within the portfolio is, you know, 50 million CAD, give or take. So we're going to stick to our knitting. You know, I think if you're playing lithium, it makes a lot of sense to look at the bigger names, for instance, because they're the ones in most cases with the processing capacity, which is a key bottleneck in that story. I think decent lithium projects around the world are a dime a dozen. There are some extremely high quality, you know, new discoveries that are being drilled out that should do pretty well. But, you know, I would differentiate between lithium and, you know, say nickel, where I would argue nickel is a core component of the battery metal narrative and hasn't seen its time in the sun yet. You know, maybe that's to come. Graphite also burned a significant amount of investors about a decade ago. So there's a lot of reluctance to wade back out into the graphite space. But the reality is, you know, if you tell me that 5 years from now, lithium prices are going to stay at their current levels or even rise higher over the period, then I would say that's just as good news for metals like graphite or nickel. And then, you know, vanadium, for instance, I would say fits into the broader battery metals narrative as well, due to vanadium redox batteries and their likely, you know, exponential growth and deployment for grid scale energy storage. And that's a metal that if you're in the space, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, you'll remember the big vanadium run up of 2017. But my sense is that, you know, most generalists that have plowed into critical minerals currently are focused almost exclusively on lithium, probably even haven't heard the metal vanadium before at this point. So I think you need to pick and choose. And then, you know, on the rare earth front is also worth considering. You know, there are some late stage rare earth development companies right now that are garnering pretty substantial multiples. And there's quite a bit of risk, you know, taking one of these deposits actually through the construction phase and through into production, you know, on time and on budget. And that's assuming you can actually, you know, lock up the large capital financing that's needed for these projects. So, you know, there's an interesting name out there that I'm looking at very closely right now in the rare earth space, which I wouldn't consider it a direct miner. It does have exposure to direct mining investments. But I think there are in rare earths, there's potentially a better way to play the theme than these late stage development projects. I mean, obviously, Lynas is, you know, to your point about going for the bigger name, is kind of the blue chip outside of China right now. So that could also be a reasonable play, you know, for rare earths over a medium time horizon.
Well, Matt, let's pivot over into some of the more, I guess, stalwart base metals, things like copper, zinc, lead, and even you could throw silver in there. You had mentioned to us before we started recording, there was two companies in Nevada that had caught your eye just because of some of the recent discoveries they've made. Love you to unpack those for our audience.
Definitely. Well, one thing we saw in 2022, and this has persisted into 2023, is a lot of excitement around CRD-type deposits. Western Alaska Minerals has made a pretty exciting discovery up in Alaska, and I was able to visit their project, Illinois Creek, in August of last year. I'm excited for that group. I think they're onto something pretty exciting there. Challenges, obviously, working up north in terms of seasonality or what have you, but they're on a good trajectory. But then looking down in Nevada, there's been a lot of action just in the past few months. I-80, like I've seen enough at Ruby Hill. Like I think, maybe I'll eat my words here, but from the results I've seen thus far, I think the CRD deposit they're drilling at Ruby Hill will become a mine. You know, there's of course, you know, permitting risks, even though they're nearby operations. They need to get more visibility into the met. But I mean, we're talking 28 meter intercepts of, you know, 500 gram per ton silver and 30% lead zinc. Like those are pretty obscene grades, you know, 18 meters at 600 grams per ton silver and 40% lead zinc. Like this looks like a mine in the making. So we're not I-80 shareholders, but it's definitely an interesting story and one I've been following closely. And the share price has definitely perked up, even though, you know, they're still a gold-focused company for all intents and purposes. The market has taken notice of the CRD discovery, and it's been reflected in their share price. You know, it's also good news for Christina McCarthy's Paycor Metals. Their project's located just to the south, along trend from Ruby Hill. And Paycor's put out some decent drill results on their own. And have also benefited from the attention, I think justly so, being paid to Ruby Hill. So we've seen the Paycor, you know, share price double in the past, 90 odd days. So investors are warming to CRD plays within Nevada. Reyna Silver also put out, you know, first drill results at their Medicine Springs project in Nevada. Peter McGaw is a technical advisor there, potentially a board member. I'm not sure about that, but I think there's going to be some more noise there. And then just yesterday, Ridgeline Minerals announced the best intercept to date at their Salina project, which I've actually been to a couple times. Ridgeline, for full disclosure, is a holding of the MJG fund. We participated in their September financing last year, and they announced a 33 meter hit of 300 grams per ton silver equivalent. It includes 6 meters of 1100 grams per ton silver equivalent. Very excellent grades. And again, from a gram meter perspective, the best hit that we've seen on the property to date. So it was good to see the share price rewarded there with, you know, Ridgeline trading up on good volume, you know, up roughly 25% on the day. You know, the cynics out there could say, well, this is the first hole that they've drilled using a core rig. And especially with CRD type systems, when you're using RC, you can see a core recovery drop off and hence an understated grade. So the cynic could say, well, we haven't seen a step change in grade here. This is just due to the core drill. But on the flip side, you could rebut, well, that means the RC drills that holes that they've drilled into the Chinchilla zone have understated the grade by about 33%. So I think it's a net positive actually from the company's perspective. This Chinchilla target is still completely open down plunge, and it was stated in the Ridgeline news release, and I agree with this, that they should hit it hard next year, and this coming spring when the thaw occurs, and we'll see how much capital they raise and how hard they decide to go. But this is a worthy target, and you know, VPX Mike Harp mentioned that they would look to get to first resource sooner rather than later there. So again, it's there's a lot of action on the CRD front in Nevada between these handful of names, and from Ridgeline's perspective in particular, I think it's a good time to be putting out these types of results. I think they have another 7 holes to go or so from drilling that occurred on targets elsewhere on the property. So we'll see some more news flow from them in the coming few months.
Matt, let's also talk about some transactions that have happened in the sector during what was a very quiet period, mostly over December. We saw some larger Japanese companies come into North America and put some money to work in some projects in actually a wide range of companies. There are a number of deals that happened. Take us through some of these deals. What caught your eye about these bigger Japanese miners entering the North American market?
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't heard or seen much commentary on it. I think part of the reason is that this flurry of deal activity was just in the week or two right before the Christmas holidays. I think in one of the cases, it was the day before Christmas. This was announced. So I think it flew a bit under the radar. You know, two Japanese trading houses in particular. The first is Sumitomo, which seems laser focused on gold in Quebec. And this is both earlier stage stuff and later stage stuff. From an early stage perspective, they have an earn-in deal ongoing with Kennerland Minerals, which is potentially a name your listeners are familiar with, at their Frotet discovery in Quebec. And, you know, as we speak, there's a 22,000 meter phase four drill program that's being mobilized. Sumi has already spent millions of dollars on the asset. I think they'll breach the 10 million mark with this program if they haven't already. So they're very excited and going full steam ahead there with the drill program being carried out by their joint venture partners, Kennerland. In December, and this was one of the news releases just before Christmas, they announced a similarly structured deal with Kennerland at the O'Sullivan project, also in Quebec. And it makes sense. They've had Sumitomo, at least thus far, has had tremendous success partnering and making this discovery with Kennerland at Frotet. So it makes sense that they're trying a round two at O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan's still pre-discovery, extremely high risk. I imagine it will be quite some time before the Sumitomo and Kennerland are comfortable going ahead with the drill test. But it's good to know that that's in the pipe for both parties. And then separate from Kennerland, Sumitomo also announced, I think this was the deal just announced the day before Christmas, an earn-in with Sirius Resources Aqualon Gold Project in the James Bay region. So also in Quebec. Listeners may know Sirius Resources and their later stage Chichu Gold Project. Just emphasize, this is not Chichu. This is one of their earlier stage assets. So it's interesting to see a group with the stature of Sumitomo willing to roll the dice on some very early stage gold exploration plays within Quebec. That seems to be a clear corporate strategy from that group in particular. And then I should also note that Sumi, in the same time period, announced that they were putting another $340 million into the JV at the Côté Gold Project with IM Gold to cover cost overruns. And this is a nifty deal. And in effect, they're increasing their project stake at Côté to 40% from 30%, though IM Gold has a repurchase right of that 10% that lasts for 3 years, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll see where that ultimately goes. But yeah, we saw a flurry of activity from Sumitomo into gold, into Canada, you know, just last month. And then the other one was Mitsui. They announced just one deal, but it was a pretty hefty one. This was with Taseko Mining at their Florence ISR copper project down in Arizona. It's in essence a prepaid offtake. Mitsui's putting $50 million into the construction financing package in exchange for a stream of, I believe, 3% or just below 3%, 80% of the offtake, and also a three-year option to buy a 10% project level stake. And so, yes, Sumitomo for gold, Mitsui for copper. But the similarities, as we've seen, you know, two Japanese groups move pretty aggressively into North America in just the past 60 days. It'll be interesting to see whether this continues.
Yeah, it's always nice to see certain companies and then large investment houses coming into an area and focusing on it. It kind of points out what they see the forecast being over the next 1 to 3 years, or they wouldn't be coming in so hot and heavy. Matt, just as we kind of were talking before this call, we were talking about the conference schedule and the companies rushing to put out news at the beginning of the year. And we were talking about all the conferences coming up in Vancouver, from the MIF and Roundup to the Vancouver Resource Investor Conference. You're going to Miami to a conference. And that led to a discussion about PDAC coming up and the inevitable PDAC curse. And we were joking about it at first, but there actually is, you brought up some great points as to why the seasonality is the way it is this time of year. I'd love you to unpack that for folks.
Yeah, I think there is a method to the PDAC curse madness. will often befuddle market participants that it proves true in many more years than you would anticipate. And as we're discussing, I do think there are a couple structural forces that explain kind of the PDAC curse phenomenon. And the first would be psychological. And we're seeing a dose of this year, you know, the healthy New Year's optimism as you roll into a new year. So I think that's definitely been the wind at the back of plenty of juniors, why we've seen a strong start to the year. That's pretty common. So that will occur in you know, January and February. And then the hopium, so to speak, will start to fade off, which is right around the time where PDAC's taking place, you know, this year in early March. So there's psychological angle. There's also a news flow angle on a couple fronts. The first is that you have a ton of companies that will defer. Obviously, if it's truly material news, it needs to be released. But, you know, that will defer or at least time their news flow to where releases that could have come out in November or December are deferred into January and February to generate early year news flow kind of ahead of the major conference circuit. So I think you see that phenomenon. You also see companies that, you know, maybe if they weren't rushing, would be putting out potential news later in the spring that, you know, pull out all the stops to get their drill results out before PDAC. So you have a compression of news flow into a month or two period. And then you have a bit of a fallow period in the aftermath. So from a rate of change perspective, you're going from a ton of news flow, you know, some of which will buoy share prices, to now a largely quieter period for the industry. So I think that's an angle. Also, from a news flow perspective, you have to look at the seasonality of some of the more remote juniors. And this doesn't apply to all juniors in any respects, but for those operating in the Golden Triangle or up in Alaska or in the Yukon or in Nunavut, you know, there's realities of how many months in the year you can access your projects. And oftentimes you'll see the heavy news flow, you know, in Q3, in Q4, into Q1. But really between March, April, and, you know, July, August, there's a real quiet period for these more remote projects in terms of, you know, particularly drill results. And so I think that also corresponds pretty well with the PDAC curse. And whereas, you know, PDAC in early March and then March, April, May, you know, for a number of months, it goes quiet for at least these specific stories. So that's a variable. And then the other one that comes to mind is financing cycles. You know, there are certain pockets of the year. Of course, it doesn't hold true every year, but there are certain pockets of the year where you see more deal flow. There are certain pockets of the year where you see less. And there's no question at the beginning of the year. I mean, we're seeing this right now with, you know, a handful of uranium and silver companies coming to market just in the past 48 hours. I mean, there's been a real flurry of financing activity. You see a lot of activity early in the year. And lo and behold, I'm not saying it's a bad decision for these companies to raise money. It's actually, I think, a good opportunity to cash up in these market conditions. But the reality is when you raise money, that's going to hamper share price performance, at least in the short to medium term. And, you know, if you're raising a deal in January and you close it, you know, mid to late January, that means that you see the 4-month hold lift in May. Or if you close it right at the beginning of the year, it could lift in April, perhaps. And so I think also when you see these 4-month holds lifting from financing activity that's occurring early in the year, that also corresponds pretty well with the PDAC post-PDAC lull that we see. So again, I don't think it's one specific factor, but I think there are multiple variables that at least help explain why the PDAC phenomenon occurs maybe more than folks would expect.
Boy, does it occur year after year, though. In all fairness, some of these conferences always mark at least a short-term top. I think a lot of the time because so many companies push news out right before, and then they don't really have anything to follow up on. Matt, just before we wrap this up, I want to circle back to portfolio strategy, because you said something early on that I want just a little bit more color on your strategy. If you do go into a more building cash environment within the portfolio, what do you tend to trim? Do you have certain rules, whether it's stocks that have already experienced good pops or stocks that don't seem to be getting any interest? How do you go about isolating the stocks that you are going to sell to build up your cash position?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There are multiple things that I'll look at, but I mean, first and foremost, always price to value should be considered. And you know, it's very difficult to value a stock, especially to an exact cent. But for each of our holdings, I have a general sense of what I think fair value per share is, with the, you know, modesty and humility to understand that it's probably off, but I'd like to think it's with, you know, close within a band close to that level. And so we do have a couple names within the portfolio that have done quite well, you know, precious metal focused in particular, that are nearing their fair value per share in my mind. Now, when that occurs, I don't automatically sell the whole position when it hits fair value per share, because firstly, I acknowledge that it's possible that I'm understating the fair value per share. Secondly, you'll often see companies overshoot. So just, you know, it can get very overvalued on a per share basis. So the idea is to start trimming, you know, as they approach what I view fair value, and then taking chunk off the table, you know, should the share price extend beyond that level. So we do have a couple names in the portfolio that fall into that basket. You know, I'll also do, from a portfolio construction perspective, max weightings on given positions, just to manage risk. So if we're far too heavy in a specific jurisdiction, if we're far too heavy in a specific, you know, single asset company where there's, you know, individual project risk that could torpedo the whole investment, things are going well, I won't hesitate to trim. And then, of course, you know, there's the instances where the companies either don't deliver what they said they would deliver, or, you know, they took a good shot and it's, you know, something didn't pan out from either a permitting or a geological perspective. You know, there are good people doing good work out there, but sometimes things don't pan out. In fact, the vast majority of times they don't in this high risk industry of ours. So these are all sorts of factors that I'll consider. But I mean, of the three, the one I would emphasize for listeners is the price to value. And you should be, you know, continually as an exercise, looking through your portfolio and having a sense of what you think fair value is for each of your holdings. And it doesn't have to be exact, but that exercise in its own right, I think, is very healthy. And it also helps encourage you to keep a more concentrated portfolio, because if you have 70 names, it's hard to know at any given time what each of them should be worth. It's much more manageable if you're dealing with a dozen or a couple dozen names.
All right, Matt, great chatting with you. Thank you for sharing some insights on how you're managing your portfolio. And we actually jumped around to a number of different areas within the resource sector. Look, overall, I think people are more encouraged, especially just in the last 4 months, of how their stocks have moved after a pretty tough couple years. Hopefully this uptrend continues, but there definitely are some more positive stories, thankfully, coming out of the resource sector. Matt, thank you as always for your time. Everybody, you can check out the MJG Capital website by clicking the link within this weekend show posting on our website and podcast. And we'll be chatting with Matt in the next couple months to get his updates on what he's seeing. Matt, thanks again for your time this weekend. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.